to escalate. Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears while we all sub sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis a song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many a days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more.
Mavis Staples with Hard Times Come Again No More. This is from the album Beautiful Dreamer, the songs of Stephen Foster, recorded in 2004. Well, today our program is about hard times, and hard times especially in Haiti and in Puerto Rico. We start off with Haiti, and our guest is Kim Ives, who's familiar to you, I hope, because he's been on with us many, many times, coursing us through that labyrinth in Haiti that just doesn't seem to give up on removing a foot from the neck of Haitians. So he's with us again today to course us through the most recent hard times that Haitians have been experiencing. And it's particularly symbolic because it is the 10th anniversary of that major earthquake, a Category 6 earthquake that hit Haiti and other islands, St. Croix, Dominica, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and Puerto Rico as well, 10 years ago. In that terrible situation, more than 3,000 people were killed. And it seems as if very little progress has been made to putting the things back together again, despite the fact that Haiti in particular has seen a massive influx of help. Kim, good to talk with you today.
Good to be with you, Yutri.
Well, thanks. What accounts for the fact that 10 years down the pike, we see little movement in terms of the revitalization of Haiti and the repairs that need to be made, the structural repairs, the help, social help that is so badly needed still 10 years after. And you've been covering this for a long time. You've been covering Haiti for a long time. From your perspective, what do you see as a problem here?
Well, I would say we really need to go back 50 years, really to the death of François Papadoc Duvalier, which was when Haiti was really opened up to what I would call the humanitarian relief disaster aid mafia And they began to swarm on the country, often through evangelical NGOs, missions who were coming not just to save the poor Haitians, but to eradicate the devil from them in the form of voodoo or whatever religion they thought they were extirpating from the people. So we see a flood of humanitarian and relief aid agencies pour into Haiti. It had the most NGOs per capita of any country in the world at most points of its history, and certainly at the time of the earthquake. And despite all these supposed armies of do-gooders coming to help Haiti, it has continued to sink and sink into poverty, even more so than before they had arrived. So
I think we should pause for a minute just to identify what NGOs are.
Oh, NGOs, non-governmental organizations. Again, one of the great misnomers of history, because every one of these supposedly non-governmental organizations is attached to a government. CARE is the property of the U.S. You look at, its name is escaping me, right? Oxfam is property of the British government, and so forth. Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, is property of the French government. So anyway, this whole idea of non-governmental organization is completely false. It's a real misnomer. But in any case, they swarmed into Haiti in even greater numbers when the earthquake happened. And the essence for the listeners to understand is that this is a big business. Humanitarian aid is the eighth largest economy in the world. This is a big business for companies like the Red Cross. We think of the Red Cross as irreproachable. You know, what can you say bad about the Red Cross? I even myself on Democracy Now, the day after the earthquake, when people were asking, you know, I couldn't say much bad about the Red Cross. I didn't even know. But here was the Red Cross, which raised $500 million, $500 million. And what did they do with it? They built six houses. This was in the course of years. I forget how many years, 3 or 4 years. But ProPublica and NPR, I mean, these are not marginal media organizations, went down there, did a study, and that's what they found. $500 million, and they built six houses. So this is the kind of irony you find. And the number often bandied about is $13 billion went to Haiti in the form of individual donations, you and myself and others, you know, sending $50, $100, and then big government grants and multilateral organization grants, etc. They say $13 billion. I've never seen an actual breakdown of how that's arrived at, but let's just say it's true. It's been repeated enough. And what was the essentially gotten? You got an assembly industry park, a sweatshop complex in the north of Haiti, very far from the area where the earthquake hit. It was 7.0 on the Richter scale, just about 6 miles west of Port-au-Prince in the Bay of Port-au-Prince. And you got that sweatshop park, and you got two luxury hotels, the Royal Oasis and the Best Western, both of which are now practically out of business, going out of business, because they didn't get all the rich investors that supposedly they were going to attract, and all their rich investments would trickle down to the population. Well, none of that happened. So Bill Clinton as you mentioned, oversaw this whole operation. He was the big director with Jean-Max Bellerive, the prime minister of Haiti. And people have tried to track. I remember going to an earthquake conference at the UN in March of 2010, I believe. And he said, yes, we're going to have a website, and every bit of money is going to be tracked. You're going to see where it came from, where it went, what it was spent. None of that happened. Absolutely none of it. Right now, people are still trying to piece together, where did the money go? In fact, there's a film by Michelle Mitchell called Where Did the Money Go? It's mainly tracing the Red Cross's misplacement of $500 million. This is the kind of dilemma we face. But the Haitian people know that they didn't get the money, that none of this great Build Back Better project, which Bill Clinton was promising, ever came to pass. So this is one of the great grievances they have against not just Bill Clinton and the what they called the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission, which was basically a bunch of banks, Western governments, and Haitian bourgeoisie, but I could say against the world that professes to want to develop and relieve hardship in Haiti, but in fact does the opposite.
And now we have compounding this, not only the fact that 10 years have gone by and we haven't seen the kind of revitalization, repairs, and so forth being made as promised by these non-governmental organizations. We have no investigation that has yielded a definitive answer where all those billions of dollars went. And as I understand it, Haiti is now dealing with another level of frustration because of this. What's going on now in Haiti as a result of all these billions of dollars literally not being tracked and people not being made accountable for them?
Well, the second big theft was the money of the Petrocaribe Fund, which was a fund established in 2008. In fact, it was signed into being in 2006, but it took 2 years for Haiti to be able to negotiate the deal in the face of the resistance of the Clinton State Department, all of which in Haiti Liberté we detailed in a series of articles based on WikiLeaks documents. WikiLeaks gave us the documents, and we wrote the series in conjunction with The Nation magazine, and those were quite well known. The result was that Venezuela gave, over the course of a decade, from 2008 to 2018, about $4.3 billion worth of cheap oil to Haiti. But Haiti only had to pay for 60% up front. 40% went into a fund called the Petrocaribe Fund, which was supposed to build schools and hospitals and roads and projects to benefit the Haitian people. About $2 billion ended up in this fund, and it was basically stolen. Most of it was embezzled, used for fake projects. The only thing they can really point to is a bridge going over the Nazon Road, the Delma Road over the Nazon Road. That is where now all the demonstrations demanding where did the Petrocaribe money go start, at that intersection. And this is the movement that has taken off and is demanding Jovenel's resignation. It began really not last summer, but in the July of 2018, because after the Petrocaribe gas finished, the IMF came in and said, you have to raise your gas prices, Haiti. And Jovenel dutifully tried to do so, but Haiti went ballistic. The Haitian masses poured out into the streets. They shut the country down. They had to backtrack on the price hike. They had to get rid of the prime minister. And the revolution, which began that day, July 6, 2018, is still going now. Basically, September, October, and November of 2019 were what they call pays lock. The country was locked down. Nothing was happening. The country was frozen, and barricades were everywhere. And that was sort of walked back a little bit in December, when Haitians like to have their holidays and people come to visit and so forth. But during that truce in the month of December, the Jovenel Moïse government, along with the U.S. Embassy, the OAS, the Vatican, the UN, the usual suspects, came and they did a sort of counteroffensive thing. We have to have dialogue. We have to have compromise words and prescriptions that they never give in Venezuela or Bolivia, but they give in Haiti. And the people said, no, it's too late for that. Jovenel, he got millions of dollars from these billions of Petrocaribe funds stolen, and they want him out. And that is where we stand today. The demonstrations haven't started again in full. The opposition is not hugely trusted because most of it is former allies of Jovenel, and the people don't really trust them. So, within a very short time, I'm quite sure they are going to start. And the main reason, and this is to wind it up, is today, January 13th, the parliament basically expires because Jovenel has held no elections. So he will be ruling by decree, and he will be able to put in any prime minister he wants. He hasn't had a prime minister. Basically, there's been no government since March of last year, when the last prime minister was kicked out because he was not seen as subservient enough to Jovenel. And so Jovenel will put in his government, but I think this is what they call in Creole, bien compté mal calculé, count well but calculate badly. Yes, he'll have the ability to put whatever government he wants, but now he has nobody else to blame. Everything is going to be on him. And to me, the demonstrations, I don't know if they're going to start this month or maybe in February. Carnival is coming up. Usually that's when a lot of things start to happen. But one thing's for sure, this revolution is not over.
Well, what is interesting here is that at the root of all of this, in the middle of all of this disaster and calamity and the hurt that people are experiencing and suffering, you have do-good organizations who tout their credentials all over the world. Look at the good things we're doing. Even the Clintons, with their foundation, they made out literally like bandits in Haiti, saying, yes, we are here to help, but the money is not accounted for. People still are not in their homes. You do not have any improvements going on to the roads and so forth that should have happened by now. And there seems to be no agency, no super agency, supervising agency at the UN or anywhere that has taken on the task of subjecting all these NGOs and tracking the money, because after all, this is people's money and billions of dollars of it. And still you have people living in the streets. You have people with homes that are actually dangerous to occupy. You have a lot of ancillary damage, but it's significant damage. And for 10 years, as you say, you know, they could, how many homes built? You know, this is amazing. Why is there no indication that this constitutes a very serious matter for the international community and for dramatic investigation and punishment?
Yeah, well, one of the problems you treat is that the press, which is in general, or at this state, they're supposed to investigate and call out all these mismanagement of funds, embezzlement of funds, etc., are part of the problem. In effect, there's a book I'll recommend to your listeners called The Great Haiti Humanitarian Aid Swindle. It's by a Haiti-based anthropologist named Timothy Schwartz. He's lived there for about 3 decades, and he knows Haiti inside out. And he has worked with all of these agencies. He went originally as a young college kid. He went to school there in Florida and went to live in the Northwest and got involved with CARE. And he started to see that all the aid that CARE was doing, it wasn't helping. It was hurting the peasants. It was making their lives more difficult. And he started there and he wrote a book, Travesty in Haiti. And that was the beginning. And really his next book, or this is really the third, but I would call this his magnum opus, The Great Haiti Humanitarian Aid Swindle, points to how you have these humanitarian agencies giving false numbers. Like we hear often that there were 300,000 people killed in the earthquake. This is untrue. They went back, they did a forensic calculation, and they discovered that somewhere between 46,000 and 85,000 people died. This is reproduced by two other studies done by people who are experts in this. So less than 100,000 people died. But what happened when Tim Schwartz, who organized that, who led that study of 20 PhDs, he did it for USAID, and USAID was appalled. They said, what are you doing? Why? We didn't ask you to find out how many people were killed in the earthquake, but he had to find that figure out to determine something about housing that he was doing, what was called the bar survey. I won't go into all the details. And they basically blacklisted him, and they said, this guy is a danger. He's working against us, but he is a guy who believes in accuracy, in truth, in the reality. And he said, no, it wasn't 300,000 people who died. It was a fifth of that. And rather than be overjoyed that many less people died, they were angry with him. So the same thing, Nigel Fisher, the head of the UN at the time, was saying there's 1.5 million people who are homeless, and that this was not true. In many cases, the towns where the tent camps, which became the symbol of the earthquake aftermath, in many cases, the population of the camp exceeded the population of the town prior to the earthquake. So they were basically giving false numbers. And then the press, rather than investigating this, saying, okay, let's see, how did you arrive at this number? Give me the proof. They just repeat it. And then the humanitarian agency takes what the press said, whether it's New York Times or AP or Reuters or whoever, and they say, you see, they said it, so we say it. And so it becomes an echo chamber. It becomes log rolling. One is giving, the other is giving, you know, they go back and forth. And so this is the problem. This is why this problem continues. And to me, this is at the root of it. We have to have the truth. We have to have reality rule and not all these games which pluck at our heartstrings, make us reach for our wallet, you know, send the money right away because somebody's suffering will be alleviated, when in fact the only thing that's really lifted is the bank account of these corporations, because basically that's what something like the Red Cross is, who are making money off of our gullibility.
So let's get back to Jovenel Moïse and his rather vague position. What is he understood to be now?
He right now is a president without a prime minister. Again, in Haiti, just to review for the listeners, in Haiti you have a president who is the head of state. He is elected in an election every 5 years, and Jovenel's election in 2016 was hugely controversial, very challenged, was covered with fraud. But anyway, the international community, which means the U.S. and its allies, stood behind him and let him keep the power. And he is then supposed to pick a head of government, what is the prime minister. And he has gone through two already. He has not been able to get a third one ratified. But now the parliament is expiring because no elections were held this year in 2019 as they were supposed to be. And therefore, he can essentially put in whoever he chooses. Again, the people want him out. He is hugely unpopular. He's been doing some kind of public relations blitz, putting out very fancy sort of panning, zooming, fancy videos on WhatsApp, trying to trick the people into or lull the people into trusting him again. But it's not working, and it's just a matter of time before another kid is shot in a demonstration or another tragedy happens, and the people are going to be out by the tens and tens of thousands, as they were this past fall, demanding his departure. And essentially, the U.S. government is sending down a delegation a week to try to buttress him. They like it because he flipped in January 10th, 2019, on Venezuela. He said Nicolas Maduro is illegitimate, and for that reason, the U.S. wants to keep him, because he's a useful puppet, he's a useful vote in the OAS, the Organization of American States, which is trying to get Nicolas Maduro out. And this is why they keep him. And Trump is, we know what kind of stubborn, pig-headed man he is, and therefore Jovenel remains in power because of that. But even at some point in time, that support, I think, will have to give way to the people's demonstrations.
So this is it's a snapshot, but very, very important snapshot to remind people, because we've done these stories before, that behind real suffering, you have organizations purporting to be interested in uplifting the people and providing help and aid and assistance. They're making a lot of money. A lot of money is disappearing that should go to alleviating the problems of the people, but simply never seems to get there. We have this effort aided and abetted by major powers, such as the United States government, and we have it also aided and abetted by other bureaucratic agencies that go along with what essentially is a pack of lies. Mm-hmm. What do you think happens next as we close out?
I think at this point the demonstrations will continue, but what needs to happen next, I should say, is that there needs to be an organization which is trusted by the people to take the leadership. Right now, these demonstrations are a little bit like giant waves crashing against rocks. The people don't have a real army to fight for their interests. And I think that is what is in the process of being born now at Haiti Liberté. I see here in New York, I know in Miami they're meeting, in Montreal, and all over Haiti, in Cape Haitien, in Okai, in Jacmel, in these different towns, these groups of seasoned militants who have been fighting really for decades, along with a lot of new young blood, are trying to build an organization, a party which can fight for their interests and really turn this popular anger into something which can be effective and really push the regime out and reestablish Haiti's democracy and its sovereignty, both of which have basically been robbed through the earthquake and through the arrival in power after the earthquake, thanks to Hillary Clinton, of Michel Martelly and now his protege, Jovenel Moïse. I think once this clown mafia is out of the way, the people can get back to the business of building their democracy and a just Haiti.
Thank you so much, Kim. As usual, very enlightening to talk with you, to hear your analysis, because you've been there for so many years now. You write as the editor of the English edition of Haiti Liberté, which is one of the most popular and largely distributed newspapers. And you're online as well. You know, you've gone with the times.
Yes, there we have it.
Yes. He's also a documentarian, and I'm glad to have him as a contributor here, because I find that we could rely on the accuracy of what it is you are offering for our consideration, and I thank you so much for your work.
Well, thank you, Yatrice. It's a great pleasure, a great honor to be your correspondent.
Thank you so much. Okay, we go next to another crime scene known as Puerto Rico. I don't want to label it a crime scene, but for the purposes of our discussion today, we have to understand it as such. Puerto Rico has been through some rough times lately, having to do almost entirely with Mother Nature. She has not been kind to Puerto Rico. You may remember that Puerto Rico was hit by Hurricane Maria. It did so much damage to the island, but also to the spirit of the island, because there was so much damage and very little that the people could do. And like in the situation with Haiti, we had a lot of aid. So that sets up the discussion right there. A lot of aid poured in, but as our guest says, nobody could figure out where it went, because there are still thousands of people who don't have roofs on their houses. There are people who are still very, very ill, can't get the services they need. And we have just utter confusion. The federal agencies charged with overseeing this project don't seem to know what they're doing. One hand doesn't understand what the other hand is doing. It is a mess. Fortunately, we have Elisa Yanza, who has been corresponding for us and with us from Puerto Rico. She is now, I think, in your most recent incarnation, Elisa, you are helping with on the ground efforts to get people the medical treatment that they need this long after Hurricane Maria hit. So the efforts are still ongoing. That is not at all understandable, given the kind of money and help that, according to President Trump, has been directed into Puerto Rico. First of all, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Richard, and for caring for Puerto Ricans here on the island. It's really an honor to be here with you and everybody that's listening to us right now.
Thank you. What's going on?
Well, Utris, if it was not enough already with 2 years after the hurricane and everything that's going on, because the hurricane situation is combined with our bankruptcy, and so even the money that the government gets from taxes is being controlled, and services, first urgency services are being limited. So you don't have the regular things that a government usually has to begin with, and then in an emergency it gets worse. And you keep on hearing how more and more money is being assigned for Puerto Rico, but the money's not getting here. I mean, the amount of money that actually has been disbursed after it's been assigned by Congress is a very small fraction. And even then, when it gets here, we can't use it because the guy from housing, the secretary, the U.S. Secretary of Housing, has not made it the ruling that is necessary. They have to have a whole structure set up or how they're going to have the money used and how it has to be documented. And that hasn't come out either, even after Congress has ordered this to happen. So none of the money for recovery, for fixing homes, for building new homes, none of that has arrived here. And for the infrastructure repairs either. And now you have a new crisis with an earthquake in the south of the island, where at least 7 towns are visibly really affected, with structures coming down, crumbling down into pieces with, thank God we've only had 2 people that have been died directly with the earthquake. But we have all these other homes that are not livable anymore. And we only got a general emergency, declared emergency from the president after the governor asked for it. But there is not any help in the near future assigned already for individual help. You know, what usually happens is that people get like $500 to buy food and get the basics if they can't go into their house anymore. They don't have access to anything they might have. And that's not happening because that type of emergency declaration has not been imposed. And we have had more than 2,500 movements, land movements, since it all started on the 28th of December. And today, after the ones in the morning, they average every hour or so like 3.2, 3.6, between 3 and 4. But I was driving back from Yauco, which is in the south, yesterday, and I got 2 of them on my way back. One was 5.6, and the other one was something similar, like in less than 20 minutes. I was on the road. I thought my car was beginning to have failures because it was like vibrating while I was going up the mountains. And I thought it was my transmission or something. But the whole situation is, people are very fragile emotionally. We didn't have any kind of earthquakes that did any damage since 1918. So basically, we're talking about, for the first time in 21 years, I mean 101 years, Puerto Rico has had a devastating earthquake. and they're not stopping. And what from what we're hearing, it's going to continue because there's a fault, the Caribbean fault and the North American fault. We're right there, product of those two plates crashing against each other, and we're right there. And there's a lot of moving around that's going on, not only here. It goes all the way to Guatemala, and we're connected to other things that are moving around on the planet right now. So people that still have their homes, even if they haven't had anything crumble down, they're sleeping outside, either in their backyard with a tent, or they're going to the baseball park in their neighborhood, or into the center of the town where people have been setting up places to stay because they're scared to death that if they're sleeping, they won't notice in time to walk out. And we have people living without toilets in under these tarps that are set up. We don't have enough toilets. There's no bathing facilities for most people who have, at this point, not been bathed for over a week. We have patients with Alzheimer lying in cots, people that, you know, it's very complex. It's very complex, and depending on who's where and who's organizing what, people either get something or don't get enough of what they need. A lot of people have not left the uphill where they live in the mountains. They have smaller communities, and that help is not always reaching them, but they don't want to come down to the city. Some of them can't because they have people that are bedridden, that are basically, you know, can't take people out and put them out in the street like that. So it's a very complex situation, and we need things that cost money. You know, we don't even have enough tents and cots for people to sleep. So people are sitting down in plastic chairs and sleeping, sitting down. And children are very upset and crying all the time. This happened on Epiphany Day, the big one. And so, you know, for Puerto Ricans and Latin American countries, the celebration of the Epiphany is like even bigger than Santa Claus coming. And this was a horrible moment for this to happen. And children didn't get their presents. Some of the parents had things saved in their car trunks, and the two of the cars were smashed under the house. So those kids didn't have anything for the Three Kings Day. And our power went off in the whole island because we have a system that is connected. All the power plants are connected. So if one fails, you can usually get power from the other. But with the earthquake, they shut down to prevent fuel or gas lines from leaking and causing fires and other things. So then they have to start checking every single plant before they turn it on again. So it was similar to what happened when Maria hit. Only, thank God, most of the energy is back now, but two of the power plants have severe damage, so we've had to turn on a few that weren't being used, that use more expensive fuel and dirtier fuel, but that are working, so we do have the power at the moment. And sometimes they do relays where they turn off one section because they need enough, they can't produce enough for the demand. So that's all happening at once. The coordination is really crazy, and our telephone communications didn't work well for a lot of us at certain moments. So when you don't have any information, it's even, you know, scarier because, as I say, earthquakes are new for us here, and so people are, you know, very concerned.
But I am amazed. Puerto Rico is America. I'm amazed that from the president on down, there seems to be no concern about Puerto Rico and what is happening in Puerto Rico, and to assure that help, long overdue, does arrive. People are suffering.
Well, you know, some of the mayors, we've had so many things with this austerity thing. People have even suggested, some of the politicians and other people want to read that are in this fiscal board that we have, the Junta de Control Fiscal, they want to reduce municipalities on the island. And frankly, Utrecht, the only people that have really been helping their people are the mayors. You know, you might have one or two mayors that have done something wrong, but basically we have more than 70 mayors on the island, and even though you look at the map and it's only 100 miles times 35, just so that somebody has an idea, in the town of Utuado, from the Walgreens, which is in the middle of the, in the center of the town, it takes 45 minutes to go through the hills to get to my friend's house. And when you look at it, it looks like it's right there. When we had the Maria incident happen, one of the guys from that was in control with the Army relief that were giving us, they were saying that our terrain was very hard for them to work. And these are guys who go down in the middle of shootings and bombings in helicopters into Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan, or and they were finding it hard to work on the in the hills here. So you can imagine a mayor to cover in the mountain range in Puerto Rico, to cover the area, it's very difficult. And if something falls down and they can't pass through, you have to go all around the mountain and come in some other way. And when you don't have communications and you don't know what's going on and you don't have enough money, and roads are also collapsing sideways since Maria, we have some of those roads are totally untransitable right now. So it's very complex. And the mayors haven't even had the money reimbursed from FEMA for the things they did, the emergency work that they did at the beginning. Once the place is declared an emergency, there's a whole ruling that has to, you know, you have to do things in a certain way, picture before and after you fix something, remove debris. Debris cannot be just thrown all together because then you can't handle it. So everything has to be separated, taken care of properly. People have to know what they're doing. Everything costs money, and a lot of the municipal governments contracted because there was this emergency declaration, and the companies knew that they were going to be covered. Well, the money's not coming down, so some of these companies cannot continue to work in this new emergency. They don't even, some of them don't even have their working force anymore because they haven't been able to be paid. So it's incredible. I know we have issues with certain politicians, but I think that the United States government knows who they are because we've been denouncing them, not me personally, but the country has been denouncing in the news and who they feel is not doing their job. So there are legal processes, but you can't penalize the whole island because a few of the politicians are corrupt. The country did what they had to do. We got rid of the governor we felt was not doing things correctly and was not even humanly concerned about his constituents, and we had 2 weeks of constant protests on the street. I mean, what else can 3 million citizens do? But what we've done so far, we can't do anything else until the elections are there. And filing suits in court right now is almost impossible because of the stay that we have because of the bankruptcy. You can't even sue the government right now. So the whole thing is crazy. I mean, we don't have regular human rights here and much less civil rights. I mean, you can't, everything with this bankruptcy thing makes people not have access to things that, as you say, United States American citizens have and take for granted. It's not happening like this. Fortunately, the people in Puerto Rico have always been charitable people. And people have gone crazy donating, and they don't even trust the official organizations to take things that they have donated. So people have been doing large caravans full of stuff. A lot of young people that I'm very surprised about have made an effort, and they were going up the hills, handing out, standing. You know, it was a traffic jam because they would actually stand and wait until every house was taken care of. And they had cold water, they had bags of ice. A lot of the artists were in on the weekend too, and they haven't really made a big promotional issue of it. They're doing it silently with the mayors because there's political people going around doing politics in the middle of everything, you know, going out with their groups uh-huh. and taking out things and having pictures taken. And I mean, it's ridiculous. The mayors have worked with each other, even cross party lines, offering, you know, the ones from the north that have resources and aren't needing them right now are taking things down to the south and offering spaces. San Juan and Bayamon have offered spaces for people to come down, but like the mayor of San Juan just announced that if she's going to offer it, she wants to offer the whole family to come, not just the sick person, the whole family, including pets, because she says that you can't separate people like this. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't help them get better if you have if you're there by yourself with nobody to from your the people you trust. So it's very complex, and unfortunately there's no centralization going on right now for things to be organized. Yesterday I had a very good experience. I work with a community center. It's for sustainable development of agriculture and community issues in Huyauco, which is one of the towns that has been affected. And I happened to find out from another group of alternative medicine doctors that were organizing to, they wanted to do something, and they didn't know exactly where they were going to go. And I said, wait, I have a place for you. It's an, a school that was canceled from the education system like 5 years ago, and this organization has been using it. It's up in the mountains, and they have 75 acres that, which are being developed for agriculture and other things. And they went out there. We had 34 people from different medical professions there, psychologists, chiropractors, therapists, all kinds of, and one regular MD doctor. And then we had 20 volunteers that brought in food for 150 people and other things for their homes. And we took care of over 200 people during the day there. And that kind of work is the work that's actually useful for people. They can stay in their area, and they take food and things back to their house. And there's a lot of emotional, I mean, the difference that it made for them to be touched and have a massage and release. We had yoga people showing them how to breathe and relax and gain control of their emotion, because the land is trembling all day long. I mean, Saturday, I think, we had 150 shakes in a day.
That's tremors, right?
Tremors, yeah.
No matter how we look at it, it is the responsibility of the federal government, first and foremost. This continues to be a major emergency. A whole island is affected. And you don't get the sense that out of Washington, whether Congress or the White House, that Puerto Rico is anywhere on the map for their concern and help. That they're done with Puerto Rico. He went down to Puerto Rico, Donald Trump. He threw a couple of rolls of paper towels. It was very funny. And he came out of there and has never looked back. His administration is not looking at the most important thing right now, which is supplying housing or helping people who sustained damage with their houses. Nothing is happening out of Washington with regard to Puerto Rico.
So, the least they could do right now, the least they can do is get the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Puerto Rico. We have a construction battalion, and construct tents in safe areas in these towns so people can be near their homes with water, with bathroom facilities and something, and cots so people can rest and give them some kind of security during the evening so they can sleep and not worry that somebody's going to do something to them. Because those things are already available and the Army knows how to do it well. They can bring in one of those big airplanes and 24 hours later, you have everything set up so that at least that works while we decide and what's going to happen and when the land starts trembling a bit. Because you can't really make plans when you're still expecting something stronger than the 6-point earthquake that we had the other day. And we just don't know when it's going to stop right now. And so, that's
But it's actually a compounding issue. First, Hurricane Maria, which did great damage, and then the earthquake and the subsequent tremors, which, as you say, continue. People are in a fragile state. But we
can't receive help from other countries, Utris, either. Because we don't control who can come in or not. That's another issue. Like Mexico, Santo Domingo, other people have to go through diplomatic permits and all kinds of other things to be able to come help. not, you know, it's, it happened with the electricity. We couldn't get linemen from other countries to come in.
My goodness. What is the most important thing, the greatest need right now, of all your needs? What is the greatest need that you see right now?
Well, first of all, we need the electric generators guaranteed on every water pump that pumps water to the island. And hopefully, if those water lines are not broken with the pipes during one of the tremors, that we will have portable water to all the homes, because the generators were taken out after Maria, the emergency after a year, and we don't have water now just because we don't have electricity from the power authority. And that, it creates all kinds of things. I'm concerned because we're already starting to see people with skin problems and other things because they can't wash, they can't clean their hands. And we have an influenza thing, which is not as bad as the United States right now, but it can get bad really fast. This is a tropical island and it's raining all the time now, so it's very difficult. And the second thing would be temporary, even if it's just tents, for people to be able to have a full night's sleep with a bathroom close by, that they can be in, have a little bit of privacy, because, you know, it's just getting to be so bad. Those things can be brought in directly, and the agencies can manage it, the federal agencies, without having to trust or not trust the local one. I mean, they can come in and provide it. And then from there, you can start stationing to see who needs what, who lost what, because it's all like organic going on, you know, Sylvester organization of things going around. And the people are really, now they don't want people to go to the south, because if something gets worse, those that are going to help will be stuck there too, and it's more people that would be needed to be evacuated or helped or could be, you know, hurt. So
Elisa, we have to stop here because we've run out of time, I'm afraid.
Yes, I know.
But don't despair. We'll connect again very soon and continue the conversation so people thoroughly understand what Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans are going through at this time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Yusrith, and blessings to everybody.
And count its many
Thank
tears
you.
While we all sub sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh,